Bartimaeus, Chapter 44. I saw the way it was the moment they came up the stairs. I could read it in the forced smile of the boy Herneck, and the reluctance with which he climbed each step. I could see it in the cold, steely look in my master's eyes, and the menacing closeness with which he trod in his prisoner's wake. Oh, yes, Nathaniel was trying to make it appear all nice and relaxed, trying to lull the girl into carelessness. Call me intuitive, but I didn't reckon things were quite as rosy as he wanted her to think. Of course, the invisible Folliot, perched on Herneck's shoulders, clutching his throat tightly in its long clawed feet, was a bit of a giveaway, too. Herneck's hands were pinned to his side by a thin, scaly loop of a tail, so he was unable to speak, cry out, or make any kind of gesture. Thin talons jabbed into his cheeks, encouraging him to maintain his smile. The Folliot was busy whispering something in his ear, too, and it is unlikely to have been sweet nothings. Lesser spirits such as this are often small-minded and vengeful, and take any opportunity to discomfort a human in their power with talk of tortures and other horrors. Others have an endless roster of smutty jokes. It's a toss-up which is worse. But the girl was oblivious to this. She uttered a small cry when she saw Herneck appear up the staircase, and made an involuntary step forward. My master gave a warning call. "Please stand away, Miss Jones." She stayed where she was, but didn't take her eyes off her friend. "Hello, Jacob," she said. The Folliot loosened its claws a little, allowing the prisoner to croak. "Hi, Kitty. Are you hurt?" A pause. The Folliot tickled Herneck's cheek warningly. "No." She gave a weak smile. I came to rescue you." A stiff nod was all she got that time. The Folliot's claws had reasserted their hold. Herneck's fake smile was back, but I could see the desperate warning in his eyes. "Don't worry, Jacob," the girl said firmly. "I'll get us out of this." Well, this was all very touching, all very poignant, and I could see the girl's affection for the boy was exactly what my master desired. Unaccountable as this was, he seemed a bit wet to me. He was watching their greeting with eager calculation. "I come in good faith, Miss Jones," he said, lying blandly. Hanging invisibly around Herneck's neck, the Folliot rolled its eyes and mouthed a silent chuckle. Even if I had wanted to tip off the girl about the Folliot, it was impossible to speak to her with my master standing right there in front of me. Not that I would have, of course. Humans and their sad little affairs are nothing to do with me. If I'd had the option of helping the girl out or dematerializing straight off, I'd probably have vanished with a ringing laugh and a gout of brimstone in her eye. Charming as she was, it never pays a jinni to get close to people. Never. Take it from one who knows. Besides, he wasn't the only problem. I now noted a couple of red spheres hovering high up in the rafters. Magicians were observing us from afar. There was no point asking for trouble. As usual, I stood pathetically by and waited for my orders. "I come in good faith," my master said again. His hands were outstretched in a sign of peace, palms upward and empty. What you could see of them under his outsized lacy cuffs, that is. "No one else knows you are here. We are alone." Well, that was another fib. The watching spheres nudged coquettishly behind a beam, as if embarrassed. The Folliot made a face of mock outrage. Herneck's eyes pleaded with the girl, but she noticed nothing. "And the wolves," she said curtly, "are far away. Still searching for you, for all I know." His mouth smiled. "You can scarcely want any further proof of my intentions," he said. "Were it not for me, you would be nothing but bones in a back alley by now." "Last time I saw you, you were scarcely so considerate." "True." Nathaniel made what he evidently thought was a courteous flourish. With all his hair and cuffs flapping, it looked as though he'd tripped. "I apologize for my haste on that occasion." "You still propose to arrest me? I take it that is why you abducted Jacob." "I did think it would winkle you out, yes. But arrest you? In all honesty, that is up to you. Perhaps we can come to an arrangement." "Go on." "But first, do you require refreshment or first aid? I see you carry an injury, and you must be weary. I can send my slave"—here he clicked his fingers at me—"to get whatever you desire—food, Hot wines? Restoratives? Ask, and it shall be done. She shook her head. I want none of your magical filth. Surely you have need of something? Bandages? Sweet herbs? Whiskey? Bartimaeus can produce it all in the blink of an eye. Again, a bit of an overstatement here, unless you had a particularly gummy rheumatic eye that took a while to unstick. Given a precise command and a partial retraction of my current charge, I can certainly dematerialize, materialize elsewhere, locate the necessary objects and return, but this is bound to take a good few seconds, or more, if the objects are hard to track down. I cannot just spirit things out of thin air. That would be silly. No. She was hard-faced, unmoved by his blandishments. What is your proposal? I assume you want the staff. Nathaniel's complexion changed a little at the word. Perhaps he was disconcerted by her bluntness, magicians being rarely that honest and direct. He nodded slowly.
You have it?
His body was stiff with tension. He did not breathe.
I do. Can it be swiftly secured? It can.
He exhaled then.
Good. Good. Then here is my proposal. I have a car waiting below. Take me to the location of the staff and entrust it into my care. Once I have it safely, you and Herneck will be given safe conduct anywhere you choose. This amnesty will last for a day. I assume you will wish to leave the country, and that will give you time to do so. Think carefully on my words. This is a handsome offer to an unregenerate traitor such as yourself. Others in the government, as you have seen, would not be so kind.
The girl was unconvinced.
What surety do I have that you will keep your word?
He smiled, plucked a speck of dust from a sleeve.
None. You will have to trust me. Hardly likely. What choice do you have, Miss Jones?
You are already in something of a corner. A savage demon stands guard over you. She looked from side to side in puzzlement. I coughed. That's me, I said.
And you have me to contend with, too, my master went on. I will not underestimate you again. In fact, he added, almost as an afterthought, I am curious to know the source of your magical defences. Very curious, in fact. Where did you get them from? Who gave them to you?
The girl said nothing.
If you share this information with me, Nathaniel said, if you talk candidly about your time in the Resistance, I will do more than set you free.
He stepped forwards then, put out a hand to touch her arm. She flinched, but did not pull away.
I can give you wealth, too, he said.
Yes, and status beyond your wildest dreams. Commoners such as yourself, with brains, bravery, and aptitude to spare, can win roles at the heart of government, positions of real power. That's no secret. You will work daily with the great ones of our society, and learn such things that will make your head spin. I can take you away from the drabness of your life, give you glimpses into the marvellous past, the days when the magician emperors bestrode the world. Then you can become part of our own great story. When the current wars are won, for instance, we shall establish a renewed colonial office in America, and will need intelligent men and women to enforce our will. They say there are vast estates to be won out there, Miss Jones. Tracts of land with nothing on them but beasts and a few savages. Imagine, you as a great lady of the Empire.
She moved aside then. His hand dropped from her arm. Thank you, but I do not think that will suit me.
He scowled.
A pity.
What of my first proposal? Do you accept?
I wish to talk with Jacob.
There he stands. Casually, the magician walked away a short distance. I stepped back, too. The girl drew close to Herneck.
Are you truly all right? She whispered. You are so silent.
The foliot relaxed its hold on his throat, but flexed its talons before his face as a gentle reminder. He nodded weakly.
I'm fine. Fine.
I am going to accept Mr. Mandrake's offer. Do you have anything to say?
The weakest of smiles.
No. No, Kathleen. You can trust him.
She hesitated, nodded, turned away.
Very well, then. Mr. Mandrake, I assume you wish to delay no longer. Where is your car? I will take you to the staff.
During the journey, Nathaniel was a ripe old mix of emotions. Excitement, agitation, and downright fear mingled unappetizingly in his countenance. He could not sit still, fidgeting on his seat, turning repeatedly to look out of the back window at the passing lights of the city. He treated the girl with a confusing combination of officious politeness and barely concealed scorn, asking eager questions one minute and uttering veiled threats the next. By contrast, the rest of us in the car were grave and silent. Herneck and Kitty stared rigidly to the front, Herneck with the foliage still entwined about his face, while the chauffeur, beyond the glass, made stolidity an art form. A block of wood wearing a peaked cap would have had more verve and individuality. I, though forced through lack of space to assume the form of a stoic guinea pig crouched between the girl's boot and the glove compartment, was my usual dignified self. We drove steadily through the London night. There was nothing on the roads. The stars began winking out above the rooftops. Dawn was fast approaching. The car engine hummed drearily. Out of sight of Nathaniel, four red lights bobbed and weaved directly above the roof of the limousine. In contrast to my master, the girl seemed very self-possessed. It occurred to me that she knew he would betray her. Let's face it, it didn't need a jinny's brain to guess that much, but was going to her doom calmly, nonetheless. The guinea pig nodded regretfully to itself. More than ever, I admired her resolve, and the grace with which she exerted it. But that's free will for you. I did not have that luxury in this world. Under the girl's direction, we drove south through the centre of the city, across the river, and into a down-market region of light industry and commerce, where ramshackle tenement housing rose three stories tall. A few hunched pedestrians were already in evidence, stumbling to early shifts. A couple of bored demi-afrites drifted past, and once a portly messenger imp also, labouring under a giant package. At length we turned into a narrow cobbled lane that ran under a low arch and into a deserted mews. "Here," the girl rapped on the partition glass. The block of wood pulled over and sat motionless, awaiting orders. The rest of us disembarked, stiff and cold in the first light of the dawn. The guinea pig stretched out its essence and returned to Ptolemy's form. I glanced about, and saw the watching spheres loitering at a distance. On either side of us were rows of narrow, white-painted mews houses, residential and a little unkempt. Without a word, the girl approached a set of steps leading down to a basement door. Nudging Herneck in front of him, Nathaniel followed. I brought up the rear. My master glanced at me over his shoulder. "If she tries any tricks, kill her." "You'll have to be more specific," I said. "What kind of tricks? Card? Coin? Indian rope? What?" He gave me a look. "Anything that breaks my agreement with her, with the intention of causing me harm or assisting her escape. That clear enough?" "Crystal." The girl had been scrabbling around in the dimness by the door. From some crevice or other, she withdrew a key. A moment later, the door scraped open. Without a word, she stepped through. The three of us shambled after. We twisted and turned through a series of labyrinthine basements. Kitty, Herneck, Nathaniel, and I, one close after the other, as if doing a slow and dreary conga. She seemed to know her way well enough, flicking light switches on at intervals, ducking under low arches that caused the rest of us to bang our foreheads, never looking back. It was a circuitous route. I began to wonder if my Minotaur guise wouldn't have been more appropriate. Looking back, I saw the glow of at least one sphere trailing in our wake. We were still being observed from afar. When the girl halted at last, it was in a small side room off the main basement. She switched on a meagre bulb. The room was empty, except for a pile of logs in the far corner. Water dripped from the ceiling and trickled in rivulets across the floor. Nathaniel wrinkled his nose. "Well," he snapped, "I don't see anything." The girl stepped over to the logs, extended a foot somewhere into the pile. Squeaking. A section of brickwork swung open beyond her. Shadows yawned. "Stop right there. You're not going in." Leaving Herneck for the first time, my master hurried forwards to stand between Kitty and the secret door. "Bartimaeus, go inside and report what you find." If the staff is there, bring it out to me. Rather more diffidently than is my wont, I approached the door, erecting a shield about me in case of booby traps. As I drew close, I felt a warning throb on all seven planes, the indication of powerful magic up ahead. I stuck a tentative head through the hole and looked around. It was little more than a glorified cupboard, a seedy hole half filled with the cheap gimmicks that the girl and her friends had pinched from the magicians. There were the usual glass orbs and metal containers. Shoddy stuff all, none of it any good. Rather in the same way that tinned vegetables are never as nice and nutritious as the real thing, elemental spheres or inferno sticks or any other weapon formed by trapping an imp or other spirit inside a globe or box are never as effective or long-lasting as spells worked spontaneously by the spirits themselves. All magicians use them as often as possible, however. It's so much easier than going through the laborious business of summoning. The exception to this was the item propped casually in the far corner, incongruously fighting for space with a few explosive lances. When I'd seen the staff, from afar, across the burning roofs of Prague, it had been crackling with the storm's power. Lightning bolts had converged on it from a rent and wounded sky. Its shadow extended across the clouds. A whole city was subjugated before its anger. Now it was quiet and dusty, and a spider was innocently spinning a web between its carved head and a recess in the wall. Even so, its energy was still latent within it. Its aura pulsed strongly, filling the room, on the higher planes, with light. Such an object is not to be trifled with, and it was with hooked fingertip and thumb, in the reluctant manner of someone extracting a maggot from an apple, that I carried Gladstone's staff out of the secret storeroom and presented it to my master. Oh, he was happy then. The relief just poured off him. He took it from me and gazed at it, and the aura of the thing lit the contours of his face with a dull radiance. "Mr. Mandrake?" That was the girl talking. She was standing next to Herneck now, one arm round him protectively. The invisible foliage had swung to Herneck's opposite shoulder and was eyeing her with profound mistrust. Perhaps it sensed her innate resilience. "Mr. Mandrake," she said, "I have completed my half of the bargain. Now you must set us free." "Yes, yes." My master scarcely looked up from his appreciation of the staff. "Of course. I will make the appropriate arrangements. An escort will be found for you. But first, let us get out of this gloomy place." By the time we emerged, the light of early morning had begun to spill into the corners of the cobbled mews and shone faintly on the chrome of the limousine on the opposite side of the lane. The chauffeur sat stock still in his seat, gazing out in front. He did not appear to have moved in all the time we'd been gone. Now the girl tried again. She was very tired. Her voice did not carry great hope. "You do not have to escort us from here, Mr. Mandrake," she said. "We can make our own way." My master was just clambering up the steps, holding the staff. He did not appear to hear her at first. His mind was far away, dwelling on other things. He blinked, stopped dead in his tracks, and fixed his eyes upon her, as if seeing her for the first time. "You made a promise," the girl said. "A promise?" He frowned vaguely. "To let us go." I noticed her subtly shifting her weight onto the front of her feet as she spoke, readying herself for sudden movement. I wondered with some interest what she planned to do. "Ah, yes." There might have been a time, a year or two back, when Nathaniel would have honoured any agreement he had made. He'd have considered it beneath his dignity to break a vow, despite his enmity with the girl. It may be that even now part of him still disliked doing so. Certainly he hesitated for a moment, as if in actual doubt. Then I saw him glance up at the red spheres which had emerged from the cellar and were once more hovering above. His eyes went dark. His master's gaze was on him, and that decided matters. He tugged at a cuff as he spoke, but his resemblance to the other magicians was now deeper than such outward mimicry. "Promises made to terrorists are scarcely obligatory, Miss Jones," he said. "Our agreement is void. You will be interrogated and tried for treason forthwith, and I shall make it my business to escort you to the tower myself. Do not try anything." His voice rose in warning. The girl had slipped a hand into her jacket.
Your friend's life hangs by a thread. Sophocles, reveal yourself.
The grinning Folliot on Herneck's shoulders shrugged off its invisibility on the first plane, gave the girl an insolent wink, and snapped its teeth beside its prisoner's ear. The girl's shoulders sagged a little. She looked crestfallen.
"Very well," she said. "Your weapon, whatever it is in your coat. Bring it out, slowly."
She hesitated.
"It's not a weapon."
Nathaniel's voice grew dangerous.
"I don't have time for this. Show it, or your friend will lose his ear."
"It's not a weapon. It's a present."
So saying, she drew forth her hand. In her fingers was something small, circular, glinting in the light. A bronze disc.
Nathaniel's eyes widened. "That's mine! My scrying glass!"
Recognizable from the dreadful workmanship of the exterior, the cheeky, workshy imp on the interior is even worse. The girl nodded.
"Have it back."
She flicked her wrist. The disc flew spinning high into the air. Instinctively, we watched it go, Nathaniel, the Folliot, and I. As we watched, the girl acted. Her hands reached out and snared the Folliot around its scrawny neck, jerking it backwards off her neck's shoulders. It was taken by surprise. Its grip was loosened, its talons snicking in mid-air, but its slender tail looped round her neck's face, fast as a whip, and began to squeeze. He cried out, clawing at the tail. Nathaniel was stepping backwards, following the spinning disc. He still held the staff, but his free hand was stretched out, hoping to catch it. The girl's fingers bore down upon the Folliot's neck. Its eyes bulged. Its face grew purple. The tail tightened on Herneck's head. I watched this all with great interest. Kitty was relying on her resilience here, on her power to counteract the Folliot's magic. It all depended how strong that resilience was. It was quite possible that the Folliot would soon reassert itself, crush her next skull, and move on to deal with her. But the girl was strong, and she was angry. The Folliot's face swelled. It uttered a reproachful sound. A crisis point was reached. With the sound of a balloon popping, the Folliot burst into vapour, tail and all. It dissipated on the air. Both Kitty and Herneck lost their balance, tumbled to the ground. The scrying glass landed safely in Nathaniel's hand. He looked up, and for the first time took the situation in. His prisoners were unsteadily getting to their feet. He uttered a cry of annoyance. "Bartimaeus!" I was sitting myself quietly on a bollard. I looked over.
"Yes?" "Why didn't you act to halt this? I gave you strict instructions."
"You did, you did."
I scratched the back of my head.
"I told you to kill her if she tried anything." "The car! Come on!"
Already the girl was moving, dragging Herneck along with her. They scampered across the cobbles towards the limousine. This was better watching than the Aztec ball game. If only I'd had some popcorn.
"Well?"
He was incandescent with rage.
"You told me to kill her if she broke the terms of your agreement." "Yes, by escaping as she's doing now. So get to it. The shriveling fire!"
I grinned cheerily. "But that agreement is null and void. You broke it yourself, not 2 minutes ago, in a particularly noxious manner, if I may say so. So she can hardly be breaking it herself, can she? Listen, if you put that staff down, you can tear your hair out more easily."
I rescind all previous orders and issue a new one, which you cannot misinterpret. Stop them from departing in that car."
"Oh, very well." I had to obey. I slouched down from the bollard and set off in reluctant and leisurely pursuit. All the while he'd been gabbling, Nathaniel and I had been watching our friend's frantic progress across the lane. The girl was in the lead. Now she reached the limo and swung open the driver's door, presumably with the intention of forcing him to drive them away. The chauffeur, who at no point in the proceedings had evinced even the slightest interest in our scuffling, remained staring forwards. Kitty was shouting at him now, frantically issuing orders. She tugged at his shoulder. He gave a sort of limp wobble and slipped sideways out of his seat, knocking into the startled girl before collapsing face down on the cobbles. One arm lolled discouragingly. For a couple of seconds we all halted what we were doing. The girl remained transfixed, perhaps wondering at her own strength. I contemplated the remarkable work ethic of the traditional British workman. Even my master stopped frothing at the mouth for a moment in perplexity. We all edged nearer. Surprise! Up from behind the body of the car popped a smiling face. Well, it was grinning, really. Skulls, as we know, don't really smile. Nevertheless, it exuded a certain irrepressible gaiety, which contrasted sharply with the lank white hair flecked with river slime, with the sodden black rags clogged upon its bones, with the fetid graveyard stench now floating on the breeze. Uh-oh. Blindingly articulate. That's me. With a clacking of bones and a gleeful cry, Honorius, the Afreet, leaped upon the bonnet of the car, femurs akimbo, hands on hip bones, skull cocked at a jaunty angle. From there, framed by the light of the new sun, he appraised us, one by one.